It doesn't. Mission.
You're listening to This Week in Radio News. Radio news about radio waves, radio art, and more. I'm Tom Rowe, your host, and we'll travel across the ether to hear what's going on in radio news. The Guardian reported last week that the world discarded a record 41.8 million tons of electronic waste in 2014, according to a report from the United Nations University, the UN's Educational and Research Branch. Norway was worst on a per capita basis, with 62.5 pounds per person generated there. The United States and China created the bulk of the waste, almost one-third of the world's total. Those countries were followed by Japan, Germany, and India in terms of bulk electronic waste. Of all that trash, only one-sixth of that is recycled. And that's even with, the UN report notes, 300 tons of gold hidden among the 41.3 million tons of trash. Quote, worldwide, e-waste constitutes a valuable urban mine, a large potential reservoir of recyclable materials, unquote, said UN Undersecretary General David Malone. Quote, at the same time, the hazardous content of e-waste constitutes a toxic mine that must be managed with extreme care, unquote. Mobile phones, calculators, personal computers, and printers make up only 7% of the items deemed electronic waste, with kitchen items taking up most of the room in the trash. You can read that full story in the Guardian newspaper. Video recordings of police officers on the job are now ubiquitous, with dash cams and body cams being installed constantly in new precincts, municipal and private security cameras everywhere, and citizens with cell phone cameras on every corner. The New York Times reports that a lawyer representing Faden Santana, the North Charleston, South Carolina man who recorded police officer Michael Slager killing Walter Scott on his cell phone, is sending out cease and desist orders to media organizations for their continued airings of the video. Fair use allows footage of such news value to be aired around the time of the news, but the copyright holder regains more rights after the initial newsworthiness wears off. The rights of citizens to record the police are not wearing off, though, and if anything, are becoming clearer. A few years back, Reason rounded up rules for recording the police that still apply. Most importantly, look up what the law is in your state. Many states allow one-party consent recording. A few states require both parties to consent in any recording, such as California, Connecticut, Florida, Illinois, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Montana, Nevada, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Washington. No matter, look up the exact laws in your state before attempting to record police officers. The Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press has a detailed reporters recording guide that also applies to any citizen. So if possible, record police encounters visibly in the open and remain calm and do not lie to police officers if approached. You may also be ordered away from the scene for other reasons, such as security. In the United States, there's no law requiring you to carry a government ID. In 24 states, though, if police have reasonable suspicion that you are involved in criminal activity, they may require you to identify yourself. You may have to ask an officer, are you detaining me or am I free to go, to find out if they have a reasonable suspicion of you. It is best to cooperate as much as you can and move as far away from the officer's attention to still record whatever is going on. Reason recommends posting any video to YouTube rather than turning it over to the police. If a police officer orders you to stop recording or you will be arrested, they may be wrong, but you still are likely to be arrested if you continue recording. Reason recommends using streaming apps that automatically show the video instantly, as well as archive a recording for later, and always passcode smartphones. Reason stresses that phones, cameras, or any other devices should never be pointed as guns. REC Networks filed a petition for rulemaking with the Federal Communications Commission April 20th, intended to help listeners tune in LPFM stations within their current 3-mile service areas, as well as help the stations reach more rural areas. Under the proposal, 50 to 75% of currently authorized low-power FM stations could increase their effective radiated power from 100 watts to 250 watts. This would increase the average protected service contour from 3.5 miles to a 4.5-mile radius, according to RecNetWorks. The Amherst Alliance and the Catholic Radio Association previously made similar proposals that focused on signal expansion in rural communities, but were tabled by the FCC due to disagreement in the LPFM community. 2013, Radio World reported that LPFM advocates Don Shellhart and Nicholas Leggett petitioned the commission to consider licensing an LP250 service with the support of the Prometheus Radio Project. So this is the latest attempt to expand low-power FM service. REC has also asked the FCC to allow 100-watt LPFM stations to move up to 6.9 miles and upgraded LP250 stations up to 8.7 miles as a minor move, and have proposed other adjustments to current broadcast law. REC Networks, established in 1984, is one of the activist groups responsible for getting the Local Community Radio Act passed and many LPFM stations on the air. REC also provides various free online services, including mylpfm.com, fccdata.org, and FCC Today, a dashboard for activity at the FCC Media Bureau, while the REC Broadcast Services provides professional FCC filing services for LPFM stations and other radio services. Andy Greenberg in Wired reports that the U.S. House of Representatives voted April 22nd, 307 to 116, in favor of the Protecting Cyber Networks Act, quote, a bill designed to allow more fluid sharing of cybersecurity threat data between corporations and government agencies, unquote. Privacy advocates say the bill, quote, threatens to open up a new back channel for surveillance of American citizens, in some cases granting the same companies legal immunity to share their users' private data with the government agencies that include the NSA, unquote. Quote, the Protecting Cyber Networks Act would significantly increase the National Security Agency access to personal information and authorize the federal government to use that information for a myriad of purposes unrelated to cybersecurity, unquote, reads a letter signed earlier this week by 55 civil liberties groups and security experts that include the American Civil Liberties Union, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Freedom of the Press Foundation, Human Rights Watch, and many others. Congressman Adam Schiff led the advocacy of the bill on the House floor, saying,
of the five main criticisms of prior cyber bills, this bill has resolved each of them. It has private sector privacy stripping of information. It has a civilian portal. It also has narrow restrictions on what the government can use that shared cyber threat information for. Gone is a national security use provision. Gone is a vague terrorism use provision. And what's left is only the most narrow of uses to prevent cyber attacks, to prevent the loss of life, to prevent serious harm to a child, and to prevent serious felonies.
The White House has voiced previous support for the bill, so the last drama lies in the Senate. Guardian reported April 23rd that David Petraeus, a retired U.S. Army general and former CIA director, was sentenced to 2 years probation and ordered to pay a $100,000 fine for sharing highly classified information with his lover and biographer Paula Broadwell. Petraeus said he was looking forward to moving on with the next phase of his life and, quote, continuing to serve our great nation as a private citizen, unquote. Petraeus was prosecuted under Title 18 of the Espionage Act, just like Chelsea Manning, who got 35 years for leaking many classified documents to WikiLeaks. Stephen Kim, a former State Department official, also violated the same act and received a sentence of 13 months in prison after pleading guilty to discussing a classified report with a Fox News reporter in 2009. Petraeus was the most trusted of the three, who arguably leaked information for the least altruistic reasons of the three. One wonders why Edward Snowden does not want to return to the U.S. for a trial. Mike Masnick at TechDirt.com reports that two very different bills about computer hackers were introduced into Congress last week. Aaron's Law, from Senators Ron Wyden and Rand Paul and Representative Zoe Lofgren, is designed to fix problems with the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, CFAA. Aaron's Law is named after Aaron Swartz, who faced 30 years in jail under the CFAA because he downloaded too many academic journals that he may have been entitled to download. The talented computer activist committed suicide instead of face those 30 years for that somewhat trivial transgression. The same day that Aaron's Law was introduced, Senators Mark Kirk, Republican of Illinois, and Kirsten Gillibrand, Democrat from New York, introduced a competing law called the Data Breach Notification and Punishing Cyber Criminals Act, although they did not release text of the proposed law, just a YouTube video and a press release. Gillibrand is quoted in the video saying,
"And this bill would seriously increase the penalties on people found guilty of hacking and cybercrime. It would raise the allowable fines and imprisonment sentences for many of the most common cybercrimes, including identity theft and theft of personal information."
Masnick at TechDirt argues that the, quote, "obtaining information from a protected computer without authorization," unquote, was the concern in the Swartz case. A too broad term was used to inflict a sentence far too harsh. Quote, "It suggests a pretty serious cluelessness about the incentives and motivations of those who commit many of those breaches," unquote, he wrote. Quote, "Increasing the number of years they could spend in time from crazily high to insanely high isn't going to change a damn thing," unquote. Read the full story at techdirt.com. Next up on This Week in Radio News, we tune in to New York sound artist Ben Mirren, who has been recording bird songs for World Wetlands Day in February and beatboxing with them. Let's hear him explain.
"In honor of World Wetlands Day, I'd like to present to you a song composed entirely out of bird songs you can only hear in wetland habitats.
Next on This Week in Radio News, we tune into Canadian radio artist Chantal Dumas, who is reimagining her 2013 installation for radio as 86,400 seconds time zones, which debuted on the Australian Broadcasting Network last week and is available on their website to download. 86,400 seconds time zones takes 24 hours compressed into 60 minutes, with the listener crossing a time zone every 2 minutes and 30 seconds. The soundscape is more crowded in places where there are people, like China and India and Pakistan, and less crowded covering areas of Siberia. Let's tune in a short excerpt of 86,400 seconds time zones by Chantal Dumas.
Coordinated Universal Time. Time Zone plus 3.
52,682, 52,693, 52,694, 52,695, 52,696, 52,697, 49,1.
Coordinated Universal Time. Time Zone plus
4.
55,000.
Coordinated Universal Time. Time Zone plus 5,700. Coordinated Universal Time. Time zone plus 6.
59,700.
From Saturday the 2nd to Sunday the 3rd of May, Soundcamp returns to Stape Hill Ecology Park in Rotherhithe with a second Reveil 24-hour live radio broadcast of the sounds of the tape break. Streamers and Soundcams around the world will be providing audio feeds from their location as the sun is rising, and Reveil will travel west from one open microphone to the next, making a complete loop in one Earth day. You can listen on site at the Stave Hill Ecology Park, or you can listen in throughout the transmission on Wavefarm WGXC 90.7 FM from the Upper Hudson, New York, or on many other participating stations. For details and how to join us, go to www.soundtent.org or mail contact@soundtent.org.